High Tide, Low Tide by Elizabeth Tarbox. The bay at high tide is an invitation. It calls and I follow, falling into the chill, wet blanket of motion and mystery. Put down your face and stretch out, it says. Relax, the element is friendly. Swim out to the raft and fill up your ears. Hear the throb of the ocean massaging the land. Experience the momentary panic of salt water in your nose and mouth. Go on, it's here for you. The bay at high tide is a sparkle of fiberglass and a slapping of halyards. It's a rolling, relentless sucking at the shore and uneasy toeholds on the backs of unseen sea creatures. But at low tide, the sand is strewn with the waves' forgotten favors. I stand, abandoned like one of the empty shells, staring out beyond the horizon where the water receded, where I cannot follow. Low tide is for reflection and acceptance. I do not belong to this water world, after all. I long to wriggle into the muddy sand and shoot out tiny fountains, like the clams, but I cannot. I can only stare into the pools from the salt spray-softened surface of the beached raft and let memories bathe me. There is a time for high tide, for being involved and active, taking risks, putting out an effort to master the elements. And there is a time for low tide, inactivity and quiet reflection. And both are necessary in our lives. May this be a low tide time for you, when you can hear the voice of your own calming and thoughtful inspiration, a time when thoughts come uncalled for to comfort or challenge you. And may you go from here renewed and ready to answer the call of your destiny, to jump back into the tide of life once more.
The door is closed again. I hesitate for a moment outside of it. Should I knock? Will it be just like yesterday and the day before? Or is it worth a try? A nurse throws me a suspicious look as she walks by. I'm still a relatively new chaplain here at the hospital. Now or never, I think. And so I knock. There is a brief delay, and then he opens it. Tall, bald, round glasses, framing eyes like two blazing bull's eyes, eyes that miss nothing. "Good morning, chaplain," he says, that same pronounced note of cheer in the voice that I have heard before. "Good morning," I say. "I just thought I'd stop in and..." "No need," he interrupts. "We are doing fine and in need of nothing." I think about the patient in bed in this room, his daughter, 26 years old, admitted 6 days ago with a head injury from a boating accident. Now she is in a coma. One of the nurses said on morning round she is unlikely to ever awaken from it. And they are doing fine. "We appreciate you coming, but we have no need of a chaplain," the father says, and this time that note of forced cheer sounds taut, ready to snap into something else, sadness, anger. But I don't have time to probe further, for the door firmly shuts in front of me. And for it just being a few inches of wood, I and this man might as well be oceans apart. Oceans have been on my mind lately, along with stories like Noah and the flood, as the hurricanes and the flooding we've seen lately have reached what we can call biblical proportions, a term that is perhaps overused, but I think perfectly appropriate in these cases. It's no wonder ancient people found the weather so awesome and frightening, puzzling and inspiring, that they created myths to try and assign meaning to these events. And it wasn't just the Hebrew people with their story of Noah, of course. A great flood appears in the ancient Mesopotamian text, the Epic of Gilgamesh, where Utnapishtim is instructed by the god Ea to build a huge vessel in anticipation of a deity-created flood that will otherwise destroy the world. The vessel would save Utnapishtim, his family, his friends, and the animals. In Sumerian culture, Zeusudra hears the god's plan to destroy humanity and in response, he constructs a vessel that delivered him from the rising oceans. In Hindu mythology, texts such as the Matsya avatar of Vishnu warns the first man, Manu, of the impending flood, and also advises him to build a giant boat. In Plato's Timaeus says that because humans had been constantly warring, Zeus decided to punish humanity by a flood. Prometheus, the Titan, knew of this and told the secret to Deucalion, advising him to build an ark in order to be saved. And after 9 nights and days, the water started receding, and the ark was landed at Mount Parnassus. You notice a pattern with all these stories here. We humans have been horrified and fascinated by natural disasters like flood since our earliest days, but more than just seeing it as a result of angry nature or a disapproving God, we have looked for hope and healing amidst the deluge. We have gone back again and again to the idea of humanity being able to build shelter against the storm, not just for one person, not just self-preservation, but for others, for animals, for the preservation of all that is good and, dare I say it, holy in life. And here we find ourselves in these weeks faced with hurricanes with deceptively simple names like Harvey and Irma, names that sound like neighbors you'd borrow a cup of sugar from or something. But really, neighbors so powerful they could destroy us if they tilt in just the right direction. And are we like Don Quixote, tilting at windmills, as we look for hope amidst the wreckage, not just from hurricanes, but from all the things going on in our world, as we search for healing amidst tragedy? Today, the door is closed again. I hover for a moment outside the room and then knock. This is my job, I think. A chaplain is there to acknowledge wounds, to invite discovery of ways to begin healing those wounds. And how could this family in these circumstances be anything but wounded? For the nurses have told me that the patient lying there in a coma had been a healthy and happy woman. And this incident came with no warning while she had been scuba diving out in the ocean. One moment she was alive and vital, and the next moment it was as though a tsunami had washed away everything she and those who loved her had known. "Good morning, chaplain," her father said, answering my knock. "Hope you are well. We are well and not in need of your services." Over his shoulder, I could see the patient's mother sitting where she always sat in a chair inches from her daughter's bed. The patient's brother, a teenager, sat on the other side of the room staring at his phone. Neither acknowledged I was there. "Just wanted you to know I was here. If you need anything," I say the words quickly, for the door is already closed. High tide between us once again. One of the things I've discovered in my time of doing ministry is that often people find their way to church doors when they are living in their own personal flood, when some disaster, not just natural ones, but any kind of disaster has shaken them to the core. At the last congregation I served, I had the privilege of interviewing some of the people for a video project we were doing. And the prompt question was, "What brought you to this community?" Over and over, I heard responses like, "My husband had a heart attack on the nature trail near here. One morning I was standing where he had died and I heard singing and decided to come in." Or, "My wife came to this church for 2 years straight, but I never went once. We had her memorial service here 3 years ago and I've not missed a Sunday since." Or, "I was managing an eating disorder and decided I needed to open up my life. And so I started coming here." Whether it was caring for themselves or a loved one who had a severe illness, whether it was the death of a family member or friend, whether it was the fracturing of a relationship in their lives, over and over it seemed that wounding had led so many people to a Unitarian Universalist community with its broad sail composed of rationalism, hope, and love. Yet so many will never find their way to a place of healing, not in a culture of quick fixes, jump cuts, sound bites, and countless numbing agents. That slow work of healing, of centering, of facing life's hurts offers little mass cultural appeal. And so communities like this one offer something hard to find elsewhere, a place where this healing can begin. Today, to my surprise, the door is open. And the patient's father, eternal guardian, sentinel by that door, is gone. As I enter the hospital room, the mother looks up from her chair next to the bedside of her daughter. For a moment, I don't think she knows who I am. I nod to her, the silence so heavy in the room it seems impossible to break. And then she speaks. "We are drowning here," she says, "one day at a time." I nod. It must be so hard, I say. She shakes her head in agreement. Her son still stares at his phone, but I can sense he is listening closely. "It can be hard," she says slowly. "Hard to admit." She pauses. "It can be hard to face what's happening." Her husband arrives at this moment. "Good morning, chaplain," he says, and for the first time there's an audible edge of anger in his voice. "We are doing okay and not in need of your services. Our spiritual needs are covered." He said it just like that. I wait for a moment for his wife to speak, but she doesn't. So I say, "I appreciate how hard this must be. If you ever feel like it's too much, please reach out to me. I can't do much, but I can listen." He takes the card I hand him and ushers me out of the room. I now know what it's like to leave those who are drowning behind. We take this moment today, here in this sanctuary this morning, so we don't leave ourselves behind. In the past year, over and over, I have heard from people that things are tough in today's world in new ways. The political climate of this country, the stress of what will or won't happen next domestically and internationally has taken its toll. For people historically marginalized, the injustices they face have been brought out into the open, but also given legitimization by the powers that be. It is a time when it is okay, more than it has been in my lifetime, to be racist, xenophobic, misogynistic, trans, and homophobic. On top of all of that, the realities of the struggles of our everyday lives are, as always, hard to hold. Not to mention the anxiety brought about by natural disasters. Like we needed that on top of everything, right? All of which can make us feel like we have the wind knocked out of us, that our sail is torn, our boat headed for nowhere or everywhere all at once. And yet from the darkness comes the dawn. From high tide comes low tide. The door is open. It has been 3 weeks since that ocean accident that brought this patient here. One of the nurses had called to me to tell me that the young woman has passed away, and it seemed like 1,000 miles that walk from the spiritual care department to intensive care, and all the way wondering if the door would be open in more ways than one. And here it is. And for a moment, I'm afraid to go through it. Who wants to step into such a wound? A family losing one so young. Who can bear that wound? I take a breath and enter the room. The tableau before me resembles the one I have seen before. The daughter so still in bed. Mother sitting by the bed. Brother on his phone. Father standing not far from the door. This time, for the first time, he says nothing. The mother looks at me.
They're coming to take her away. We only have a few minutes. She speaks as though those few minutes are all that remain of anything. The father looks at me. We don't go in for religion, he says, but I have appreciated our talks. What?
I wonder what he means by that. All we have seemed to have spoken of is his desire for me to have go away.
I mean, he says slowly, brokenly, it was good to know someone cared. Yes, I say at last. That's what it's mostly about for me, acknowledging that others care.
He thinks for a moment and then says,
it's going to take us a long time to get over this. I nod. A long time, I think. A lifetime. An ocean of time. And yet somewhere in those waves that go up and down, those high tides and those low tides, there are moments of peace.
And maybe, just maybe, if those wounds are acknowledged and tended to,
maybe, just maybe, if they reach out to someone else to help heal those wounds, maybe there is some kind of lasting peace ahead. The orderlies arrive to take the body away, and I feel it is my time to go, and I wonder when and how this family will begin that healing. Scars will remain, of course, from such a loss, such a hurricane coming into their lives. But healing is indeed possible. And I think it's the scars, I know it is for me, that help us to find wellsprings of compassion and empathy that we didn't know existed. We can't operate out of living out of our open wounds. No, that's too much. The heroes in those stories of those who survived the flood, Noah and Utnapishtim and all the others, they were regular people with one exception. They had healed enough from humanity's wounds that they could lead others to a place of healing and hope. They could build an ark and ask others to get on board with them. And I see it in the stories of places like Texas and Florida in the aftermath of hurricanes and Mexico post-earthquake. Stories of people helping, pulling themselves out of their own wounding to reach out a hand to others, trudging through water and wreckage and desolation into spaces of hope and possibility. People willing to make a difference. There's no one way to heal from the wounds that we carry. At some point, we've all been wounded. Some sit here today with scars, but few open wounds. And some have found this community at a time when the wounds are fresh. Know that, as hard as it sometimes is, just as it was for that family in that hospital room, the door needs to remain open. Know that all are welcome, whatever you carry or don't carry. Know that this is a place of love and justice. Know that we acknowledge and embrace our imperfections even as we work to transform ourselves for the better. Know that we carry on in love because it's worth it. Because that baby's cry tells us it's worth it. Because we're needed. Because there is a great ocean of possibility, oceans the size of our hearts. Some possibility that is horrible and awesome and terrible, and some of it joyful and peaceful and wondrous, but all of it possible, all of it eternal, all of it as majestic as where the ocean's horizon meets the dawn of a new day. This morning we're going to have time, meditative time, I guess you might call it, time that I'm going to invite you forward in just a moment to make our own little piece of ocean. I'm going to invite you to place a pinch of salt into the water from our water communion last week in acknowledgement of the sting of our wounds and the releasing of that sting. Giving back that wounding, that sting, to the oceans from which all life comes. A time in which we acknowledge that for all the work we have to do out in the community and the world, and we do, and we know, we have a long list, we also begin here with our own healing, with our own potential and capability to find spaces and reasons for hope in doing this work. So as you listen to the sound of the ocean waves, I invite you, as you are moved, and if you wish, to come forward to place a pinch of salt into the water and have that be a reflection of your own healing. There is great sorrow, but there is great possibility. And when we come together, those possibilities are often beyond our imagination. And now my one magic trick. Let's hope it works. So we've made our own little bit of ocean here. And we will give this back to the greater ocean. And we will keep in mind to be gentle with each other, to be kind, to recognize that what we see on the surface is not always reflective of all the things that are going on for any one person in this room. And that when we do work together, when we hold each other in community and love, we are indeed in a great blue boat headed home.